There you go. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to do a little research here in a moment, but my memory of that song, one is it when it first came out, it took over the country and nobody could sing anything else because they hit a nerve is the expression. But my recollection of how they came to write it, how it came to be produced, is that the folk music was coming on, and business side of the ledger said, we better get some material of that type. They didn't know anybody. Certainly didn't know or want to know Pete Seeger or anybody like that. But anyhow, they turned to one of their writers and said, you think you could write a song kind of like this folk stuff we're hearing? And he said, oh, yeah, I could do that. And he happened to be the son of, and he said actually most of his family were working people, were miners. And one thing he remembered was the expression, another day older and deeper in debt. And of course, there was at the time that his relatives were working. Oh yeah, it's this name. By the way, this guy is a genius. Noted, look him up. He's Merle Travis, an absolutely wonderful guy. But Merle said, "See, he didn't have to go and ask Bob Dylan or Pete Seeger or anybody. His family were miners, and he knew all the language, the kinds of things they would." Just say to one another. So he just took that, put it together. My understanding is he wrote it in about 24 hours or less. Often the greatest songs are written very quickly. I think the guy who wrote, the woman who wrote Heartbreak Hotel did it in about 20 minutes. And she phoned up Elvis and said, hey, come over here. I want to tell you something. I'll show you something. And he came over, and he said, hey, I think we got something. And the way she wrote that song, according to her and her son, who helped her, was to a truck driver that she knew had stopped by and knew she wrote songs. And he says, hey, I got a little item here. Maybe it might be an idea for a song. And it was one of those little 3 or 4 inch clipping in a small town newspaper, and it said that they found a body of a man, and beside him was a note, and the note read, "I live at the end of a lonely street." That was all, and she said, "Bingo," and she sat down, and that's how they got the song. It is kind of nice. It's some of these things that we sing and then hear. Start with some kind of just small detail, unfortunate event. Anyhow, Merle Travis wrote the song 16 Tons. And certainly 16 Tons will always be there and very powerful. I would love to know where it ranks in terms of, you know, most popular, but my own memory is that there was a time when it was practically, you couldn't go in it, you couldn't pass a jukebox, et cetera, or in and out of a place without hearing it. This is, in case you were wondering, the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Let's mention the Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the two cities that suffered nuclear attack by a nation that never gets mentioned. Hopelessness know this. They have commemorations, and it's everybody remarks on how tragic the two bombings were. That the use of at that time basically a super weapon. But at these occasions, no one says who dropped it. A year ago, we were doing the show about, and I think it was Oppenheimer was the film about him. was somehow, I guess, some wise person scheduled it for the anniversary to increase the audience, I guess. I don't think a thing has been learned. If we're looking for lessons, I suppose you get the biggest lesson from we can't mention who did it. although American leaders periodically have flashed remarks about Trump. Of course, Donald Trump has made some vulgar references to the weapons. There used to be a senator from South Carolina, I think his name was Hollander. And at one point, many years back, not when I say many, 15, 120 years ago, they were talking about bad trade problems. There was a little nastiness in conversation between the U.S. and Japan. And he took the occasion to say, I only have two things to say to the Japanese negotiators. Hiroshima and Nagasaki is what he's a United States senator. He was not censured. Nobody said, hey, you know, you can't talk like that. It's being discussed. I tell every year, by the way, the same story because I thought it was worth reporting. The Japanese philosopher who had spent his career writing meditations on the use of atom bombs on those two cities. And he was exploring what it is, how such things happen, is involved and you know how much hatred is built up on during wars and basic stuff. But then he said one of the questions he wanted to deal with, and it always bothered him, was he understood how, given the hatred that is inevitable once wars begin, hatred is. Runs right straight through societies, and really bad things happen to innocent bystanders. So he said he understood that this bomb, the Hiroshima bomb, he could understand where it came from in terms of product of the war, its use, the decision to use it. But he said he was troubled. Well, the second one, the bomb that dropped on Nagasaki, the anniversary was yesterday. And he said that, you know, that he tried to understand why the second bomb was dropped. And he said after many years of meditation and thinking about it, he realized the answer was that there were only two bombs. So they were out of ammunition at that point. We now have a new context of the bomb discussion. It ought to be mentioned. The government of Japan now has a defense minister who says that they ought to be talking about Japan and nuclear weapons. And he says it is not a taboo subject. We've talked about it on the Taylor Report before, but Canada should clear its voice, actually should find it, and say it is a taboo subject. You were the initiator, one of the two major initiators of World War II. You lost the war. It was basically unconditional surrender, which meant that the terms were written out for you, and you agreed. And for the betterment and the safety of everybody, you agreed to be a neutral, a state with no offensive capacity. You were not going to do that. And we, therefore, the rest of the world, who had fought with Japan, particularly China and the people of Korea and all through Asia, didn't want to see a repeat. So there was an agreement it wouldn't be one. Now we have a Japanese defense minister talking this way, also talking about long-range ballistic missiles. These are offensive. And talking about guaranteeing other people's territorial integrity, that is to say Taiwan. So that is a very dangerous situation, and it shouldn't be under the not being followed or commented on by our media, but frankly it's not. Actually, to the extent that it is being commented on, it is they've framed a new way of talking about it. And the new way they talk is they say, isn't it good, isn't it great, now that our friends there in Asia are starting to talk about looking, defending themselves and not so dependent on the Americans. And they, you know, can save us a little money. They'll be developing their own capacity. And isn't this a good development? The answer is no, it is not a good development. It is quite the contrary. And what they're doing is camouflaging their desire to have Japan as a foil against China. That's all it is. And this is prelude to conditions such as we had before the Second World War, where Japan actually was given, so long as they were attacking only Asians, that was fine by the British and the Americans. That's good. That's okay. But then the Japanese went one step further and actually struck at the center of world civilization, London and New York, and the French. The French were knocked out rather quickly. They actually gave it up. We actually ought to be looking at all these, re-examining these moments in history and see how the parallels that exist, because it's not something spiritual or mysterious. States that wish to be powerful and prosperous and based on their control over capital, they will always come into clashes with each other. There's a man who used to write for the Monthly Review named Scott Nearing, and he said, well, war is inevitable. And these states will molest each other sooner or later. And of course, there's an attempt to prevent it. And that was the United Nations. And while everybody says, oh, it's useless, well, not entirely. It's one of the few things that, you know, keeps everything from going, getting completely out of control. At any rate, I come back to the issue, bombs. We need, and we do have, treaties on non-proliferation. Some states are members, and that, you know, this is not a mere symbolic operation. This is, it actually has a mechanism for guaranteeing the subject of how many bombs will nations have, what they will, whether they are agree to the treaty of non-aggression or non-use of the weapons, and there's the issue of nuclear energy and guaranteeing that it doesn't, that it is not something that could be converted to development of weapons. These are important treaties. And we need, frankly, we need more of them. And since Ronald Reagan, we've been tearing them all up, actually. Reagan signed some, but in the latter part of his government and with the beginning of the victory of the declared victory, illusory victory of the U.S. in the so-called Cold War, they began to think that these nuclear things were not important anymore, that they would use their power to guarantee a Western civilization, which would become world civilization. This is the Tater Report, CIOT 89.5. FM. I mentioned earlier there has been an agreement struck between Pakistan, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This is one of those things where I like the language that is. I follow UN debates, not terribly closely, but closely enough to hear certain expressions that are very pertinent. One of them is, let's all have respectful and transparent and working relations with every state on the planet, so that we can achieve, get along. And if there is a difference, and two or three parties decide that they need to work together more really closely, that's fine. But the issue becomes, are you doing this? Are you going to have a body, Pakistan, I'm speaking specifically, Pakistan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, is that a one that does not violate the rights of others? So if you enter into a pact, anybody who's outside the pact has a right to, and you must guarantee that if you want, assuming you did that, you want it for peace, well, the other party also would like peace. So you have to make guarantee to them that the three of you are not getting together for some bad purpose. It's to use the word defense, everyone has a right to defense. So it's the word I'm looking for is indivisible. All the parties have that. And if so, you can't say you're looking for merely defense, but you don't offer to the party that is outside the agreement, you don't strike with them an agreement where they understand that you're not threatening them. But this is, frankly, a threat. Zafar Bengash believes, told me by email that he thinks this is a pact against the Islamic Republic and against what he describes as the Houthis of Yemen. Certainly, Saudi Arabia has found the Yemen to be a problem that they once thought they could crush. I remember when many years back, we talked about it on the Taylor Report, that when the Saudis really went to war with Yemen, thinking they were going to install a friend of theirs in power and get rid of the so-called, I'm not terribly familiar with the word terms, but the Houthi government of Yemen. Yemen is actually under dispute as to who the government is. But the most powerful group is obviously that one that is called the Houthis. And when the Saudis went to war against them, they called on Egypt and they called on Pakistan to help them. And for a very brief period, there was help, but actually those states backed off. So here again, now we have Pakistan involved in this. So this is going to be very interesting, this, because you're talking about the Arab world, and of which Pakistan is not a part. And if they become involved if that's what the goal is, there's going to be some heavy shocks, because at the moment there's also the Islamic Republic of Iran, who have failed to do everything that Donald Trump wishes them to do, and far from it. And so the area is inflamed. There is tensions there that could really lead to some dramatic changes. So we'll keep an eye on that. And I we'll do our best. We might be able to get Zafar for a future conversation on the subject. Lastly, I want to mention this matter of that we often do, about the Rwanda issue of they have refugees, they have an army in East Congo, and something very helpful has happened. The Congolese government has taken the government of Rwanda to the International Court of Justice. And now this, I want to repeat, the Taylor Report talks about it a lot. The International Court of Justice is an actual bona fide United Nations creation. It is not like this hybrid thing, the ICC, which is has been totally ineffective and caused more trouble than good. In which, by the way, Russia is not a member of the ICC, China is not a member of the ICC, so the United States is not a member. So you don't have a world system. What you have is an idea which is not tenable. Either, you see, with the United Nations, it's everybody's in. And that's why the International Court of Justice, everybody's in. The ICC, people opt out. They say, oh, it doesn't apply to me. And it's just been a waste of breath. But the great thing here is that Congo is accusing Rwanda of having forces, Rwandan forces, in Congolese. They start with Zaire, Congo, and that they have committed massive crimes in eastern Congo. This is an issue between two states, members of the United Nations, and all United Nations members will have to address it one way or the other. And I will be looking to see with interest whether or not other states join the action by Congo. Their case is very clear. There's really no disputing that the facts are that the Rwandans attacked eastern Congo. They said to, by the way, they call that self-defense. And if you recall, there was a leader in a place called Zaire. His name was Mobutu. And the Rwandans said that they wanted to protect themselves from Rwandan exiles in eastern Congo. And they ended up going all the way to Kinshasa and destroying the government of Mobutu. They overthrew the government of Zaire. That wasn't self-defense. They used the lie about the refugees in East Congo. We talk on the show. I know the Taylor Report listeners are actually conversant with what I'm talking about. But I'm telling you that, in my opinion, there's a very important development. And this one is one from which Rwanda will not be able to hide, because they have to make an answer. They are a member of the UN. They're being told by another member that they're guilty of heinous crimes in eastern Congo, and they will have to, of course, compensate, and they will have to get out. And this is not, Donald Trump has nothing to do with this. This is a United Nations matter between two states. And so we will follow it closely. I've had people tell me, well, you know, these things take a long time. Yeah, they do. South Africa brought an action against Israel, and Israel has to make answer. And the beauty of it is, well, this is the UN actually functioning. And we hear the evidence, and the nations have to line up. Of course, the court will hear the case, but all nations will pay close attention. And this benefits everybody. And on the matter of how long it takes, the important thing is it's being argued right in front of us, and the facts are known, and they have to be presented by responsible people, not by just people with, like myself, but responsible people, real people. And this is a benefit in the ICC, which I think we ought to get rid of. They take years and years to accomplish nothing. They arrested Mr. Bagbo in Ivory Coast, held him for 8 years and then said, oh, well, we don't have a case and sent him home. That's a farce. So I say celebrate it. The Congo is bringing Rwanda to the book. This is Taylor Report, and 33-45-78 is coming up, you lucky folks.